Now let's see if I can get over here. Squeeze it over if you need to.
So,
quarter after eight. We're 5 minutes early. We're early. How about that?
You're now on your way.
Hello,
Mike. Hello, Rhett.
Welcome
to the hot seat, huh?
Yeah. Okay. This is as big a you know what for me as it is for you.
I don't believe that.
I don't know.
Good you time should. Was had by all.
Do you know what all's going on in here with this crowd this time?
No. Is this coffee cup fouling anything up? I'll be happy to pour it on the floor.
Go ahead and keep it till you finish it, and then after we're going to do a lot of little spots, so there'll be plenty of time to get out of the way. Let's make sure that mic is on top. How does he? Let's hear some sibilance or something out of it. If you got good cans, let's see. It's under
talking
his tie.
Talking sibilant tones. Is that what you said?
Does he sound good to you? I just
put it on the floor.
Neil's was buried so deep it sounded muffled. I want to make sure we got you clear. Leave it alone until they tell us. Just talk a little, Mike.
I mumble just normally. I have to change my whole delivery to come in clear.
Okay. That's crisper, yeah.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. First thing I want to get you to do is to, we just want in the clear your voice saying, I'm Michael Collins, Command Module Pilot, Apollo 11. At your leisure, just look right at me and say, I'm
Michael Collins, Command Module Pilot, Apollo 11.
Good. Now, think about it a sec if you want to. Give me a...
I think.
I got.
They don't replace me or anything like that.
The best question of all will be... How did you get from childhood to 110 kilometers above the moon?
Slowly, I guess. It's been a long haul. It's been nearly half a century, as a matter of fact. But happy I am to be where I am.
Okay, really, the serious thing where it was in a 15 to 30 seconds, will you tell me, in your words, a description of the mission, Apollo, the objective, the reason for Apollo 11. Why are we flying Apollo 11? Now, keep the cup down when you answer it.
Okay. Well, the whole Apollo program was, of course, designed to get two Americans to the lunar surface and back again to Earth safely. Apollo 11 is no more or no less than the culmination of the build-up flights, the sixth or the fifth manned flight. We've had four preliminary flights, and now we're prepared with Apollo 11 to go on and to make a success of that landing and return. The enormity of this event is something that I'm not prepared to evaluate before such an event. I've essentially been nowhere and done nothing, and you're asking me to evaluate something which we hope very much will happen within the next month, but I think that only history will be able to judge. Obviously, we've opened up a travel system which is heretofore been impossible. We now will be able to offer to human beings the option of either walking on the surface of the Earth or walking on the surface of the moon, or hopefully in some not too far distant date, the option of walking on the surface of some other planet. And I think that the possibilities therein are almost limitless. However, as I say, before such an event, I'm poorly equipped to say in great detail what they may be. Historically, we've been unable to predict the benefits of various inventions or various discoveries.
Thank you, Mike. Is he still sound all right, the way that Mike's getting under his tie there? Do you purposely mount him under the tie that way? Does it matter to you guys? Okay. I meant to tell you, we have EBU, the European Broadcast Union, for all of Europe and practically the rest of the world, TV. NASA headquarters, doubling in with us here. VOA here. And I think some other people are getting some stills out of it, too. So we really doubled this session up to try to get maximum usage out of it.
Right.
Julian twisted my arm, you know.
Okay.
Okay. overall mission is command module pilot. Now, I'll just ask you the question and just reflect on how you feel about your job. Mike, as command module pilot, you have some very important things to do, many of them alone. How do you look at your role as command module pilot?
Well, Apollo was designed to be a three-man job, and the third, which I perform, is as important, no more so, no less so, than the other two positions. I think I'd be a fool if I said that I had the best seat of the three. On the other hand, I can say with complete candor and with complete honesty that I'm very happy to have the seat which I have and to be doing the job that I intend to do.
If I were listening, I would have heard what you said.
Well,
two or three other things. Okay, then go right into the biggest thing that I think all of us are most excited about talking with you on is methods of rendezvous, the preparations you have made, rendezvous, and particularly rescue capabilities. So let's go into some on that too, if we can. I'll just feed you a question and try to go back and forth with you on it. Mike, you'll be one man in a three-man command craft during parts of the flight, the most important part, the crucial return to the mother ship. You're going to be rather busy, aren't you?
Yes and no. I hope I'll be very unbusy. I have two roles to play. First, I act as the passive target vehicle, and in the event that everything is working perfectly within the LEM, then I am not unduly busy. I have many chores to do, and I prepare to take an active role in bringing the two vehicles together. However, as I say, provided the LEM works and can, its radar is working properly and it's capable of making each and every maneuver leading up to the rendezvous and docking, then my job is essentially a quiescent one. On the other hand, should difficulties arise within the LEM, then my job is to rescue the LEM, and I then find myself becoming the active partner in charge of a very complex vehicle with a very complex job, and this is when I truly become busy, and I'm literally racing from one side of the cockpit to the other, getting solutions to various problems from my digital computer, making sure that my rendezvous radar transponder and VHF ranging systems are working properly, and doing a host of other small details, all of which are necessary for the successful completion of the rendezvous.
To what extent do you prepare mirror image rendezvous figures? Just during the descent, there is a point at which the lunar module is beyond your having reverse maneuvers prepared, isn't there?
Well, I, of course, once the lunar module is deep into its descent, then I am unable to do any sort of mirror image maneuver to bring the two vehicles together. There's a point of no return beyond which the LEM is, you might say, on its own. And in similar fashion, the LEM must be able to lift off from the lunar surface and be able to inject itself into a safe orbit. These things are necessary. I play no part in these portions of the mission. However, once the LEM has reached a safe orbit, then literally almost an infinite number of possibilities offer themselves. There are situations in which the LEM is ahead of the command module, others in which the command module is ahead of the LEM. There are some cases, orbital mechanics are peculiar things. They say that the higher you go, the slower you go, the lower, the faster. So we take advantage of this fact in our attempt to bring the two vehicles together. And the vehicle ahead normally goes high and slows down, while the vehicle trailing goes low and therefore catches up. This strategy prevails for a certain combination of vehicle relative positions, beyond which we find that, for example, if the LEM is trailing, then it can no longer catch the command module, and now we want to bring the command module around and catch the LEM. So we reverse our strategy, send the command module low, raise the LEM high. At first, as I say, this appears to be almost a bewildering number of possibilities, but they do they boil down to several categories of general situations, and we approach them that way.
You are in the spacecraft, though, that has the almost infinite possibilities, and you are the one who's had to train on this great number of possibilities for rescue. Don't you feel somewhat overwhelmed sometimes with the
I would, were it not for the fact that I get a great measure of help from the ground. The Mission Control Center is staffed by a great number of people, each of whom is an expert in some particular part of the mission, and the rendezvous side of the house is very adequately staffed with experts, and I mean really true experts, people who have devoted a major portion of their lives for the last, half a dozen years at least to solving these problems, and I have the utmost confidence in their ability to help me, and otherwise I would in fact feel overwhelmed by the possibilities.
If you've got communications, you have help.
That's true, and of course, there's always a possibility that we can lose communications, and these are the games that we play in our training. We say, well, suppose the LEM found itself in this strange orbit, and then suppose we lost communications, and then suppose the other bad thing happened, and we pile one little catastrophe on top of the other and try to see whether we can extricate ourselves from the difficulty which we've pretended we're in. And this is why training for us is so complicated and time-consuming. The normal flow of events in the mission are relatively simple. There are many places in which we have the capability to make some dreadful error which is going to cause the mission to be lost. But in general, the main flow of normal events is fairly straightforward. It's only when you get into suppose this breaks and suppose that breaks and suppose the other breaks that you really find yourself faced with these incredibly complicated situations.
Is there any particular facet of rendezvous, docking, or rescue which you feel is more exciting or important than another? What stands out foremost?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to look back on it and tell you what was most exciting.
What do you feel that you have to concentrate most on, or is most crucial then? You must have learned some of this.
Well, but unfortunately, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and we don't want any one link to be obviously weak. So if we spot one that seems like a soft spot or a weak link, well, then we drop what we're doing and focus our attention on it for a while. So hopefully each and every sequence along the way has been practiced and rehearsed and worked out to the point that we clearly understand it, and it's no longer a weak link. So I hope that I'm unable to answer your question now, and I hope that I'll still be unable to after the flight. I want this chain to be all strong links with no weak ones.
Thanks very much, Mike Collins. And that's the end of that one. Okay, let's go back through the little biographical part just for, you've done this with me before, but it's sort of outdated. Can you hear me okay? You hear me all right?
I just barely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and hold this thing here. May I take it out for a minute? Right, I'm going to...
Yeah, it's a lot better.
Now, can you hear me better here now?
A lot better.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Collins, you've flown before in space. In
right.
Gemini 10, had an exciting flight in that one, as a matter of fact. But first, let's talk just a little about you. What part of the country do you come from?
Well, all parts of the country, Chet, really. I was born in Italy. And, Rhett, I'm
you
sorry.
You want to start over?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
No, I don't want to start over. Do you?
Okay. What part? That it's a good lead for you to say all over. I was really. That's what I wanted. Go ahead. Same bit.
No, go ahead. Let's start all over. Good morning, Red.
Good morning, Mike. How is it in there? Up there.
Fine.
Mike Collins, you've flown before in space and. Listeners around the world have heard of your exploits before, but let's review just a bit about you yourself. Where were you born? What part of the country did you grow up in?
Well, Red, I'm really from no one part of the country. I like to think that I've lived a little bit in nearly all parts of our country. In fact, I was born in Italy. My father was in the American Army on on duty in Italy, and I returned to this country very young, so unfortunately I don't remember that. However, I have lived north and south and east and west, and if I'm pinned down, I say that I'm probably either from Houston, Texas, where I currently reside, or from Washington, D.C., where I spent a number of years. But in fact, I'm not really, I don't really have a hometown.
Now, your father and your uncle were prominent military men, weren't they?
Yes. My father was a major general in the Army, and my uncle was Army Chief of Staff for several years after the war.
How could a son of two prominent Army men go on into the Air Force?
Well, good judgment, I think. No, seriously, I liked the Army very much, and I've been very happy in the Air Force, so it was a very difficult decision to make.
I presumed you just liked airplanes.
I did, in fact.
Tell me about your career in the Air Force.
Well, I started out, of course, going through flying school, and from there I went on into the fighter business. I went through fighter weapons training out in Las Vegas, Nevada, and learned a few things out there besides fighter tactics, and then went to George Air Force Base in Southern California into a fighter wing flying F-86s, and flew one of the 86s over the North Atlantic route to Europe in the wintertime. And it was a supersonic airplane, and I managed to average 3 miles an hour for the trip. It took 30-some days, but it was very pleasant. We spent New Year's, and I think we spent Christmas in Goose Bay, Labrador, and we spent New Year's in Bluey West 1, Greenland. And that was a very interesting trip. And then I spent 3 years in Europe as a fighter pilot, in primarily in France, with also some trips to various NATO countries, as well as North Africa, and then returned to this country.
Didn't you serve as a test pilot also at Edwards?
Yes, later I came back to this country and was assigned to Edwards Air Force Base, and went through the test pilot school, and then later when it was created, came back and went through their aerospace research pilot course, which was sort of at that time a postgraduate course, and in between I was assigned to fighter test at Edwards and had various projects involving new fighter aircraft.
Did you know Neil or Buzz before coming here as an astronaut?
I knew Neil. I knew Neil, who was stationed at Edwards, working for NASA Flight Research Center, flying the X-15 and other aircraft. Buzz, I had never met prior to coming to Houston.
How do astronauts prepare their families? Speaking generally for you, your family, and other astronauts and their families, how do astronauts prepare their families for a mission of this sort?
Well, I think the families prepare themselves. There's no conscious effort on my part to prepare my wife. My wife has a mind of her own, and I think I would probably fail if I started out a program of indoctrination for her. She does quite well on her own. So I would have to just say in general that the process by which we arrive at going to the moon, of course, has not been one gigantic step. It's been arrived at bit by piece, first flying airplanes and test flying airplanes, and then coming into the space program and giving that idea several years to settle, and then getting a Gemini flight and seeing how that was, and then on to Apollo. So it's been a little bit by bit process.
Mike, you've had a mode of decision making which is striking. You didn't have to think twice when you were faced with a go all the way decision when you underwent surgery of the vertebra. Do you apply this sort of thing to your work as an astronaut too? How do you compare such things, and how do you face these crucial decisions in your life?
Really, I've had to make very few decisions that have been the real tough ones, which are the ones that are the two sides of the argument nearly balance. And if there's a preponderance of evidence on one side or the other, then I mean the decision is really almost made for you. And I've been very fortunate in not having any cliffhangers. My operation's a case in point. There really wasn't any decision to make. I was in fact going to have it done. You know, if I agreed, I'd have it done pleasantly, and they probably would have carried me off biting and scratching if I'd not agreed to have it done. I don't really mean that, but in fact, there really wasn't much of a decision to be made. And a lot of things about flying, airplane flying or space flying, are clear-cut, open and shut cases, no decision required. An airplane catches on fire, you jump out. People say, how did you decide to do that? Well, it didn't take a lot of smarts to figure it out. There it was, laid out right in front of you. On the other hand, there are a few 4951s, and those are the ones that aren't too pleasant. We hope we don't come across many of those.
Thanks very much, Mike Collins, and good luck on the mission.
Rhett, thank you.
Whoops, that's the end of that one. How much time, John? A couple minutes, okay.
I keep forgetting you're segmented. Every time I think you really mean it when you say goodbye.
Do a little sign-off on each one here. Okay, pressure suits, you specialized in suits when you weren't on cruise.
I did a number of years ago, yes.
All right, let's talk just a little about this segment, and also your own, we can go back to your EVA. This doesn't involve you, but
sure.
It just brings out your experiences a bit. You're not going out this time.
No.
Okay. Mike, you have specialized for a time in work on pressure suits used by astronauts. You had one of the most exciting periods of extravehicular activity on your Gemini 10 flight. What do you feel is good, bad, or otherwise, and what direction do you think that pressure suits are going? Are we going to get them any smaller in the future? Are they really safe?
Well, I've been out of the pressure suit business for several years. As a matter of fact, I was the suit subject for the suit competition, which picked a particular company which designed the suit that that Buzz and Neil will be using when they walk on the lunar surface. And I feel now, as I did at the time, that the suit they'll be wearing is the best possible suit they could have. It will not always be that way. I think, as in any particular part of American technology, somebody is always trying to come up with a better idea, and thus it will be in the spacesuit business. And I think today there are probably improvements upon the theme, and as we go down the line, there will be small and perhaps some very large improvements made in the spacesuit business. It's a tough business. People who are working night and day, to design a joint which can imitate the human shoulder. But if you try to write the equations of motion of a human shoulder joint and all the convolutions through which it moves, and then you try to translate that into bellows and pipes and wires and coils, you find you're very frustrated. It's a difficult thing to do.
And, but you feel comfortable inside yours now, right?
All pressure suits inherently are uncomfortable rascals, but I think, yes, in general, they've been made as comfortable as is possible.
Thanks, Mike. Just one quickie. Mike, this is serious, sir, really, if you can ask. How would you feel if you had to come home alone?
Terrible. Really.
That's it. Thanks very much, Mike Collins.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Timekeeper. The blower of the whistle.
We held you close.
Did we treat you right that time?
It was nip and tuck.
Mike, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good luck, buddy.
Thank you very much.
Sorry the glass is here.
I'm sorry they locked you up over there.
Yeah. Who?